Hello and welcome to episode 2 of Space Talks, a science-based show with a particular interest in all things with regard to space. This is Stephen Lowry along with co-host Tim Woods on Vancouver Island. And hello, Tim. How are you today?
I'm feeling well and looking forward to today's show.
Tim, you mentioned last episode that we aren't rocket scientists, and indeed each episode requires both of us to do a lot of research and updating our existing knowledge, and hopefully these talks will spur listeners on to conducting their own research. Now, Tim, with regard to updates, I believe that you have some news for us.
Well, I was wanting to remind folks and update us on the Artemis initiative by NASA, which is targeting return to the moon. And Artemis 3 is the launch of the spacecraft that will take humans back to the moon, at least take Americans and, in this instance, one Canadian to the moon. And we do have a list of the candidates. There are 4 active astronauts in the Canadian Space Agency, and one of those individuals will soon, probably within the next, within the late winter, early spring, be named to that Artemis 3 crew. Those candidates are Jeremy Hansen from London, Ontario, Joshua Kutrick from Fort Saskatchewan, Dr. Jennifer Seide Gibbons from Calgary, and the lone astronaut who in this quadrant of 4 has already been in space is David St. Jacques. So he flew in space in 2018. I have to say, Steve, it's quite an impressive resume. This fellow has got himself a commercial pilot license. He's a family doctor, an astrophysicist. He speaks English, French, basic Russian, Spanish, and Japanese. That's quite the resume.
His name comes up in an update that I have from the Canadian Space Agency itself. On January the 20th, the CSA announced that it would support commercial space launches on Canadian soil. And present at that announcement were President Lisa Campbell, who is a graduate of McGill and Dalhousie, Mark Garneau, who was our first astronaut, and he's the former CSA president, and the aforementioned Canadian astronaut, David St. Jacques. And they announced that these launches will help position our country as a leader in commercial space and benefit the economy. And I wondered about benefiting the economy, so I did a little research and found out that in 2020, the Canadian aerospace industry contributed over $22 billion in GDP. And that created close to 207,000 jobs for the Canadian economy.
I think the future is really bright. I understand there were 180 launches, commercial launches last year. The growth in that is also, it's darn near exponential.
It is, and appears that the chosen site will be near Canso, Nova Scotia, and operated by Maritime Space Launch. And it sort of intends to have a working name of Spaceport Nova Scotia. When construction is completed in 2025, they anticipate about 8 missions per year. And I found it kind of interesting that the launch rocket that they'll be using is a Ukrainian-designed Cyclone 4M, and its first customer is NanoRacks, based in Houston, Texas. And this company has already deployed 64 satellites in space.
Well, I hope it's not too soon to wish them the best of luck with this new initiative.
I guess not. We're going to start off our first half of the show with talking about meteor impacts on the Earth. And Tim, in the second half, I believe you're going to be talking about meteors that don't hit the Earth and asteroids and comets.
That's correct.
And we have a quote here from Neil deGrasse Tyson. Asteroids have us in our sight. The dinosaurs didn't have a space program, so they're not here to talk about this problem. First of all, I'd like to start by talking about a famous impact on the planet Jupiter, which occurred in July 1994. American astronomers Carolyn and Eugene Shoemaker, along with the Canadian David Levy, discovered a comet which had come around in 2 years before in 1992 and had subsequently broken into 21 smaller pieces, and they were about to enter Jupiter's atmosphere. And the largest was only 5 kilometers in diameter, and yet it hit the atmosphere with such a force it created a temperature rise from minus 143 degrees Celsius to 23,700 degrees Celsius in scant seconds, and created a fireball 3,000 kilometers high in the atmosphere. Now, the force of that impact really shook up all the astronomers and astrophysicists on Earth, because it was equal to 6,000 times the Earth's entire arsenal of atomic weapons. And that really made us realize that how impactful force these things do have on us. So there are four main large ones that I want to talk about here and how they've affected the Earth. Fortunately, Jupiter acts as sort of a big vacuum cleaner. And a lot of these asteroids which would hit Earth are attracted by Jupiter's gravity, and they hit Jupiter instead. But one called the Vreta Ford in South Africa was created about 2 billion years ago. A meteor 20 kilometers in diameter created a massive crater 300 kilometers wide. Now, at that time, the only life forms on the planet were single-celled organisms, but the shock waves and ejecta surely modified the atmosphere, making life more habitable for what we have now. The second one was discovered only in the late 1970s, and it's the Chicxulub crater in Yucatan, created 66 million years ago. And this meteor was only 10 kilometers across and it hit mainly in the water, but nonetheless, with such a force, it went through the water and punched through the crust, creating a crater 180 kilometers in diameter and 20 kilometers deep. Now, what I found amazing was that some of the meteor's ejecta flew upwards at such a speed. Now, some of the stuff from the Earth that hit went flying upwards at such a speed, it exceeded escape velocity, flew into space, into somewhere now out there in the solar system. But the majority of the ejecta fell back to the Earth. And as it did so, it heated up going through the atmosphere. And so you've got thousands upon thousands of mini meteors coming down around the world, and it destroyed some 70% of the world's forests. And of course, the subsequent fires that we had, a lot of forest fires in BC in the summers, and we get smoke. Well, the smoke occluded the sun, and this occlusion ended up destroying some 75% of all animal species on the Earth. And the third, which is of particular interest to us, is the Sudbury Basin. And it was created some 1.8 billion years ago. And this meteor, 20 kilometers across, formed a crater 130 kilometers across. And when it slammed into the Earth, it punched a hole into the crust 15 kilometers deep. Now, when it did so, this allowed the molten mantle below to well up and fill the basin with hundreds of tons of nickel, copper, palladium, gold, platinum, and other precious metals. And the Sudbury Basin has the largest concentration of mines in the world. And its wealth was only accidentally discovered in 1885 during the construction of the CPR. And I found that absolutely amazing that you have the world's greatest conglomeration of mineral wealth near the surface, and no one knew about it until the railway was built across Northern Ontario.
Steve, I want to come back to a point you made about the dinosaur killing meteor impact. And you mentioned how the ejecta, some of it escaped velocity, went back out into space. And I believe it's the case that a great deal of ejecta from meteors impacting, well, the moon and Mars and other solar objects makes its way back to the Earth as meteors. It's a fairly important way in which we learn more about those other solar planets and what have you.
And that is going to be a topic, I think, for another time, because I find it amazing that they can find a chunk of meteor on the ground and say, oh, this came from Mars. How in the world did they know that?
And I presume a great deal more material of that sort is ejected from the planet into space because of the very marginal atmosphere that those other planets have.
The gas helium on Earth, you know, that we use and fill up birthday party balloons, when that escapes from the balloon, the internal velocity of the helium atoms is such that they have escape velocity. And so all of the free-flowing helium eventually floats off into space and leaves Earth. They don't need a rocket ship to do so. That's absolutely amazing. A couple of other things about the Sudbury Basin. A PhD candidate named Joe Petras at Laurentian University believes that the impact was by a comet rather than an asteroid. He published his findings in the Terra Nova Journal, and more about that perhaps in the future. And incidentally, the Apollo astronauts on 15, 16, and 17 went to the Sudbury Basin before going to the moon to be able to recognize impact rock formations, or breccias, so that when they went to the moon, they could see whether the rock there was formed by lava or by impact. So thank you, Sudbury Basin. And finally, we have the Papagai Crater, formed in Siberia some 35 million years ago. Now, this one is really neat. 35 million years ago, they only discovered it in 1972. And this meteor slammed through a layer of graphite existing in the soil with such an impact. It was traveling at about 54,000 kilometers per hour, and it instantly melted and transformed thousands of cubic kilometers of existing graphite into industrial grade diamonds. The interesting thing is, just like Goldilocks, porridge was too hot and one was too cold and so on. Here, at the point of impact, the heat was too much for the graphite to change into diamonds. The diamonds actually occurred a little further away, about 14 kilometers away from the center of the impact. But nonetheless, there underneath in Siberia is the world's largest conglomeration of diamonds. So in summary, we've got a South African meteor impacting and changing the atmosphere to make life more conducive. We've got the Yucatan impact, which destroyed vast numbers of animal species, allowing perhaps mammals to come into the forefront rather than the reptilian-type dinosaurs. The Sudbury Basin impacted and created a wealth of riches for Canadians, and the Siberian impact created the world's largest deposit of diamonds. The salient point, I think, here, Tim, is that impacts do affect life on Earth.
Steve, I wanted to start out with some topical news, really, about the damage that was recently done to the lone Soyuz spacecraft that's docked at the International Space Station. That didn't happen very long ago, and coolant was noticed leaking from that spacecraft. Now, right now, there are 7 astronauts and cosmonauts on board the International Space Station, or ISS. And this leak, it was hard to find initially, and they needed to use the Canadarm to locate the damage. What they found was a approximately 1 millimeter hole in the coolant loop. Now, analysis has shown that this damage was caused by either space debris or a micrometeor. There's no immediate risk to the International Space Station, but it seems unlikely that the Soyuz will be used to transport any astronauts back to Earth as had been scheduled, and that now another Soyuz is going to need to be sent up to provide that relief.
Well, you know that given the constant amount of human-created space debris, and couple that with the knowledge that each day, and this is hard to believe, each day 100 tons of micrometeor dust from burned-out meteors lands into the atmosphere, it seems that the ISS is facing increased impact dangers.
No doubt. And there's various kinds of shields that are employed by the space station, and in fact by other satellites that try to protect against these objects. Right up to something as large as 1.5 centimeters, but it's a complicated set of math because it is complicated by the speed of the impact and the mass of the approaching threat. So there's no guarantees, and it does bring to mind the kind of Hollywood blockbusters. If you think of movies like Gravity, or going back a little further, Deep Impact and Armageddon. But, you know, the dodging of space junk, dodging asteroids, worrying about planet-exterminating asteroids and comets. And it takes our conversation a little bit further out to field to the asteroid belt that lays between Mars and Jupiter. And it brings about an interesting intersection between Hollywood blockbusters and the real world of space exploration. Now, in a typical blockbuster, what happens is there's an observation of some incoming asteroid, and then a frantic effort is made by missiles or spacecraft with heroic astronauts that's going to be sent out to the asteroid, destroy it or budge it, and do so at a distance so far from the Earth as to protect us from any impact whatsoever. Now, in terms of differences, Hollywood always has to have things that will bring people to the theater. So there's going to be a love story. There's going to be a U.S. president struggling with one thing or another, and there's usually some badly behaving journalists that are all too keen to leak an end-of-the-world news story on an unsuspecting public. What they don't rely on is an unmanned spacecraft, because in the theater, that might be just a bit too boring, but in reality, it's anything but, and that brings us to the DART mission. DART stands for Double Asteroid Redirection Test. Now, NASA launched a spacecraft in 2021, and it arrived at the target asteroids in the fall of 2022. It's a very small asteroid target called Dimorphos. The DART mission followed the Hollywood script pretty well. NASA wanted to determine how feasible it might be to protect Earth from an incoming meteor by sending a spacecraft with the single purpose of crashing into the meteor and budging it and removing the threat and protecting the Earth from that potential damage. This was the first attempt humans have ever made to execute a plan of this sort. In 2021, think about this, they launched the mission and an impact vehicle aiming for a target the size of a football field that is already moving at great speed and is some 11 million kilometers away from the Earth. 9 months later, that impact vehicle, which is the size of a vending machine, is aimed with the precision necessary to hit the target. And you can watch most of the final sequence of events on the internet right up to the moment of impact. It's extraordinary.
It is. And you know that the speed of DART and Dimorphos were roughly equal. They're both traveling at about 24,000 kilometers per hour. But given that the asteroid had a mass of 5 billion kilograms compared to DART's mere 570 kilograms, that's a factor of 10 million. Was DART's kinetic energy sufficient to actually change the trajectory?
Well, I think the analysis of that impact is going to be carried on for quite some time. But it does seem initially that the change in trajectory that's been noticed had more to do with the ejecta, the material blown off the moonlet, than that had been caused by the kinetic energy imparted at the moment of impact. Perhaps that's a function of the composition of this moonlet or some factor associated with the gravitational relationship between the moonlet and the larger binary asteroid that Dimorphos circles. That one's called Didymos.
Well, so there's an issue of scale here, and maybe the kinetic energy in this case could move the moonlet, but could it move a larger, more typical asteroid?
You know, at this point, the lessons learned from the first mission suggest a more Hollywood-friendly solution. We need to put more explosives on board and get a bigger bang for the buck. But seriously, it's a fair question to ask whether the pint-sized moonlet is a genuine concern to Earth and whether such meteors are few in number or not. Just recently, a meteor the size of a bus zipped by the Earth, quite close in fact, and we were assured that had the meteor entered our atmosphere, it would have burned up or broken into bite-sized pieces of no real consequence. But going from a bus-sized asteroid to a football stadium-sized asteroid, well, that might be a different story, but still not overly alarming. In terms of the asteroid belt itself, there is a lot less mass involved given the sheer number of asteroids, space rocks, than we might imagine. Certainly the rocks are spread out at a great distance, hundreds of thousands of miles apart, and the sum total, the mass of all the asteroid belt's material, is just 4% of the mass of the moon. In other words, mostly small boulders. And it seems that if you take the four largest, they account for 60% of the total mass.
Well, let's count that as somewhat reassuring, but I understand that NASA has what's called a Near Earth Object Observations Program, which is part of a planetary defense. And that's designed to locate, track, and characterize NEOs, as they're called, which are 140 meters and larger in size. And perhaps that's a topic for another date.
We're being looked after, I hope. I do want to mention another meteor mission that is getting underway this year, and this one's named Psyche. This is one of NASA's so-called low-cost, high-quality missions that will launch in October of this year. There are a couple of aspects to this mission of note. Of course, the most important is the rendezvous with the meteor, Psyche, and that should happen in the year 2029. This particular meteor is much closer to Jupiter and Mars and will require a flypast of the red planet in order to get the gravity assist necessary to reach the target. Researchers have determined that this particular meteor is not made of the more common material, but is actually a composite of metals. And the expectation is that it will be made of nickel iron ore composite and be the core of an earlier planet. Now, the definition of what an earlier planet requires a bit more homework, I believe. By early, perhaps they mean failed, I'm not sure, perhaps that's going to be part of the findings 6 years from now.
And you mentioned there were perhaps two aspects to the mission.
That's right. The really interesting tag along is to the Psyche mission is known as DSOC, or Deep Space Optical Communication. Now, here's the problem. Looking forward, scientists know that we are going to be collecting an ever-increasing amount of data from the various missions beyond the Earth atmosphere. Part of the challenge is to transmit that data efficiently back to Earth, and of course, sending data from Earth to the distant missions. DSOC is the first time NASA will be using new laser-based means to transmit data to and from deep space. That aspect of the mission is going to get underway once the spacecraft heads away from the Earth and will carry on at least until the point where the spacecraft has swung past Mars. This is a little like the ground-based evolution of data sent over telephone wires and then onto fiber optic cable.
So success is the ability of these laser beams to find their mark and for the data to arrive in one piece or at least lots of pieces in the correct order. And we're not talking about data uploads at greater speeds, the speed of light being the governing factor applying to any of the transmission speeds of today or tomorrow. So that means that we're still going to have lag times, but perhaps the information will be more compact.
That's correct. And I think we don't have much time left today, Steve, but if we do, I did want to mention that the great mass of asteroids, comets and meteors, and even dwarf planets lies beyond Neptune in the Kuiper Belt. All that material lies in what is described as a donut-shaped ring, and there may be hundreds of thousands of icy bodies larger than 100 kilometers, and an estimated trillion or more comets within the Kuiper Belt. However, I guess we have to admit that we still don't know very much about the Kuiper Belt.
You know, I don't even know who the gentleman Kuiper is. I assume that somebody, and going to be a topic for one of our other episodes, how various things in space got their name.
Back in 2019, one spacecraft, the New Horizons mission, did fly past one asteroid in the Kuiper Belt named Arrokath. That spacecraft left Earth in 2006. First, it had to go past Pluto and then carry on another 1.6 billion kilometers. Arrokath has the distinction of being the object furthest from Earth ever explored by us Earthlings.
That is incredible. And you know, that is a mention and a factor of scale when we talk about things and distances such as 1.6 billion kilometers. And that's going to have to be a topic in another episode about how we can wrap these large figures and try to make them more understandable. That is going to be quite an amazing task. And that's an incredible mission that you mentioned for all kinds of reasons that didn't make the news. And I sometimes wonder why mainstream media doesn't. Perhaps one or two of our listeners out there have heard of the story and they can tune us in and perhaps send us a message at spacetalks@voiceoftheshoeswap.ca and let us know about either their knowledge of it, where we can find it, or ask them other questions that we can do a little research on.
Steve, what's coming up in our next episodes?
Next episode, we're going to be talking about stellar evolution, the birth, main life, and deaths of stars.
Well, this wraps up this episode of Space Talks, which dealt with some aspects of comets, asteroids, and meteors, and what happens when they hit the Earth. Tune in for our next episode, which will be about stellar evolution. Should you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please drop us a line at spacetalks@voiceoftheshoeswap.ca.
And so this is Stephen Lowry
and Tim Wood
saying so long, and we'll see you next time on Space Talks.